basically just like the master. He knows everything about everything. So how did you get into that?
Well, that's from owning and being around pawn shops. Before internet, pawn shops didn't have quite the knowledge that a guy like me has as far as instruments and other things. And they always would ask me, what's this worth? What's that worth? Because it would be coming out of pawn and they owned it, or someone was coming in for a loan and they wanted to make sure they didn't overstep their bounds or understep it and lose it to another pawn shop. So that started in the early 80s for me. As far as the Guns N' Roses thing, that's kind of a quick story. The person that I bought the rights to Poison, to manage Poison from, her name was Vicki Hamilton. And Vicki Hamilton said, look, I can't work with Poison anymore. I don't have the money. I don't have this. And we're fighting all the time. Will you get me out of my debt that I borrowed, which was $4,000? And I gave her the $4,000 and I bought the management of Poison. And they were happy about it too. But I also told her I'd help her out with her next project for coming out. And she was doing like Faster Pussycat and a bunch of other bands like that. And all of a sudden she came up with a band called Guns N' Roses. So next to my guitar shop on Sunset, we had a meeting at El Compadre. And I agreed to fund the band up until whenever. And it was up until they got signed. And I put a bunch of money in. I believed in Vicki and I believed in the band. And we were the ones doing all the shows on the Strip. Slash got his first Les Pauls, which weren't Gibsons. They were Max Les Pauls from me. And then later on, he got Derek Les Pauls from actually his manager back then was Alan Nevin. After they left Vicki Hamilton, they went with a guy named Alan Nevin. And then later on, they went with Doug Goldstein later on. But I always kept in touch with him. And, you know, Slash is a great guy. I didn't have that much interaction with Axl whatsoever, but Duff's a great guy. Izzy's cool. I was friends with Steven, even when Steven didn't remember who I was because of the state of mind he was in. I was at a Motley Crue show backstage and I got him in. They weren't even going to let him in. They didn't know who he was. And he was kind of bombed out of his mind. I lifted him over the barrier back then and I got him in. I mean, just, you know, crazy life story. But the thing is like, I always will remain friends with the guys from Guns N' Roses, even though there's not any communication between me and Axl anymore. Every once in a while, I'll have some kind of conversation with Izzy or Steve Duff, even Steven Adler or Matt Swarm, who drummed with them, even with the other band that they had with the singer from STP, Scott, you know, rest in peace.
That's actually, there's an interesting personal tie-in with Scott there too, not to cut you off. Cause remember when he died, we were selling parts of his recording studio and estate.
His current wife sold everything to myself and a guy named David Eckelby, who does the Hollywood show, the Autograph show, great guy. And we bought everything that was available from the house cause she needed some money to pay some bills. We got everything. I think you wound up with a couple things, right?
Oh, yeah. A lot.
Yeah. Some of them were iconic because one of the things we wound up with was an old custom colored Jaguar that was Vachante's from, at that time, it was from the Red Hot Chili Peppers. And we did real well with all this stuff. We gave her a fair price, but we did real well. And everyone was happy. In fact, the detectives called me up because they were handling a civil case between the ex-wife and the current wife. And they wanted to know if I was sure that I bought all the stuff from the current wife. I said, yeah, I went up to their house. And after a couple phone calls, they called me back. They said, we need to know enough. You're in the clear. Everything's kosher. And, you know, which is good because you don't want to cause any grief for anybody, especially not for myself or David. We didn't step on anybody's toes and we wound up getting the okay and it's kosher from the detectives and we were fine.
So one thing I was wondering, I've been thinking about this a lot. I think hair metal, there was a lot of interesting stuff aesthetically in that movement, in that 80s LA scene that I kind of feel is like about to reemerge or make some sort of like, I don't know, formal synthesis or comeback. I think there's like this element of like romanticism. Like that was like the last truly like hard partying rock and roll generation. And, you know, these kids, the artists today, they're not like that. If you could sort of go through like maybe some of the most like debaucherous stuff you've seen or try to like talk about the way in which, you know, rock and roll has changed, that could be pretty interesting too.
It's pretty funny because in the mid to late 80s, every hair band was mimicking each other. And there's none that really broke the mold except for becoming successful. There was no rhyme or reason for who was successful and who wasn't successful.